Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
For a record sixth time on our program over the course of 5.5 years, I am very pleased to have as our returning guest Rodney Stark, a distinguished professor of the social sciences at Baylor University and co-founder and co-director of Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, our patron organization. A prolific scholar and author, Professor Stark has written 38 books and over 150 academic articles. Among those books are some all-time favorites of mine, including For the Glory of God, How Monotheism Led to Reformations, Science, Witch Hunts, and the End of Slavery; The Victory of Reason, How Christianity Led to Freedom, Capitalism, and Western Success; God's Battalions, The Case for the Crusades; America's Blessings, How Religion Benefits Everyone, Including Atheists; and most recently, The Triumph of Faith, Why the World is More Religious Than Ever, just published by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. We will provide links to these books, along with his personal website and to Baylor's ISR over at our website, so please do peruse those resources. Baylor has a lot of stuff going on, and most of it is open and free to the public, so if you're in the Waco area, please do stop by. They're not just a football team, even though they ran up 654 yards in a bowl victory over UNC a few weeks back. So congratulations, Bears. Sick 'em. Rod, it is good to have you back on Research on Religion.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you, Tony.
Your latest book, The Triumph of Faith, has a very provocative subtitle, Why the World is More Religious Than Ever. And this is provocative, especially in light of what seems like a never-ending barrage of studies and media reports that religion is in a rapid decline here in the United States, if not a overall collapse. We'll get to the rest of the world in a bit, but I would like to get your thoughts on studies presented most notably by the Pew Research Center, but also a few other places, about the growing increase in nuns or non-affiliated individuals in our nation. What's your thoughts there?
Well, there are a lot of things wrong with what Pew reports, and one of them I suppose we should start with. It's like a lot of people, they recognize the bad news sells. The fact of the matter is, if you had a report, church attendance hasn't changed for 50 years, and it hasn't. That's not news. Nobody cares. But you say, it's all gone down the tubes, and there's been a great increase in the proportion of Americans who give their religious affiliation as none. You get headlines. Unfortunately, the headlines are very misleading. What's really happened is that people who used to say, who didn't ever go to church, okay, who used to say that they were Presbyterians or Protestants or something, are now saying none. And what they mean is no specific local church. They don't mean they're irreligious, and how do we know that? Well, because they say they believe in angels, they believe in heaven, they pray. Now, of course, 4 or 5% of Americans are atheists, and they are included in there. But the nuns are not growing, nor are the atheists. 1944, Gallup asked for the very first time, asked a national sample of Americans, do you believe in God? And 4% said no. 2 years ago, that was asked again, and 4% said no. Big deal.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that comes up in this, and it gets to questions of definitions, is what is the difference between somebody who is religious and somebody who is secular, a term that you use in your book quite a bit. How are you defining those terms? How does Pew approach this kind of stuff, and what is the best way to do it?
Well, it seems to me that you can't get hung up on particular religious denomination or kind. I mean, let's put it this way. If suddenly tomorrow no one in the United States was any longer a Christian, but every single one of them was now a Buddhist or a spiritualist or a Muslim, would you say that America has been secularized? And the answer is, of course not. People, all of those people believe in the supernatural. All of them believe in religious morality. Whether or not Christians and Muslims worship the same God is a theological issue of perhaps great interest to some people, but not to sociologists of religion, in the sense that both groups believe in a supernatural power that rules the universe, a creator, a God. So these kinds of changes are of great interest, but they are not measures of secularization at all.
One of the things that surprised me in the book was the surveys that you report. A lot of people are maybe not reporting belief in God as defined by Presbyterians or painted on a Catholic ceiling or something of that nature, but they fill it in with lots of other stuff, such as astrology, tarot beliefs, and fairies, and all these other different things. And does that count as religious as well too?
Well, it counts in belief in supernaturalism. Remember what the secularization theorists say, that belief in the supernatural is going to disappear. They don't just say Christianity is going down. They say people will no longer believe in the supernatural, any aspect of it, all right? But I'm sorry that astrology is supernatural. And the fact that beliefs in those kinds of things are so prevalent in parts of the country. You know, there are more occult healers in Russia than there are doctors. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of this stuff around, and it matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the other things that struck me as well, too, and I just love this statistic, is in Iceland, which is considered to be one of the most secular nations on the planet, not many people go to church. Religious attendance is oftentimes used as a metric for religiosity. It might not be the best one. It might not be the only one. But in Iceland, where people don't attend church, what was it, something around 50% believe in these things called Huldufólk or hidden folk, which are elves, and they actually have elf locators that come out to homes and to spot if there's a bad place to build a building.
Yeah, and they also check the plans to build new roads so they don't go over elf hills and that sort of thing. But you know, that's all well and good, but the fact of the matter that was always staring us in the face is that on polls, only 3.5% to 4% of people in Iceland say they're atheists. If you say you believe in God, then that's, you know, that may not be what a preacher wants, in the sense he wants somebody coming to church, but the fact is you can't count those people as secularized. It's just silly.
One of the other things that has been in the news a lot, too, relates to the nun category amongst these younger folks that they call millennials. What are your thoughts on reports that the young are falling away from the church?
They're departing from the church, yeah. You know, I have a table in my book that supports that view entirely. It shows that people under 30 are less likely to go to church than people over... people over 30 and people over 30 to 40 are less likely than people 50 and over. Very clear, fairly strong finding. The trouble is that that table I show in the book was from data collected in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to say for, these many, many years, is that you'll always get a table that looks like that because young people, after they've left home, have a tendency to greatly decline in their church attendance. And then they get married, and then they have children, and they all go back. And this has been going on as long as we have any data to look at. And it gets very tiresome to see almost every 10 years we have this big report that all the young people are leaving the church and we've got to do all these things to try to get them back, and they haven't gone anywhere. They're just sleeping in on Sunday morning because they're young and unmarried and staying out too late Saturday night.
Could it be a possibility that a bump or a small statistical bump upwards in this group in recent years has been due to the fact that people are marrying later and childbirth has been delayed to the late 20s and early 30s as compared to the early 20s about 20, 30 years ago?
Well, it would certainly, probably if we look carefully at the data, we'd probably find that the go back to church is a little bit later than it used to be, that maybe now you find people under 35 being the lower attenders instead of under 30. But the same principle applies. Eventually they go back to church.
Mm. Let me get your thoughts on this, and this wasn't in your book, but we had David Campbell on several months back, and he is the co-author with Robert Putnam of the book American Grace, and he had a novel explanation for what he thinks are going on with the millennials and this whole nun issue, and that is an increase in the linkage between religion and politics, most notably among what is called the Christian right, and this is turning off millennials. Do you have any thought about that?
Nonsense.
Mm. And the reason?
I mean, there was a big push on this, and it goes back to Campbell and Putnam and some of those people as well, that all this was going on, that evangelical youth were turning left and changing their views and rejecting their parents' right-wingness and all that sort of thing. And my colleague, Byron Johnson, did a study and got a whole bunch of national data, looked at it very carefully, and if anything, these young evangelicals are even more conservative than their parents. It just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start talking about the data here, because much of the doom and gloom about the waning of religious vitality has been reported through the Pew Forum or the Pew Research Center, a few other places as well. Your book, however, relies upon survey data from Gallup Organization's World Poll. So discuss this survey in respect to, say, Pew, the World Value Survey, which is another frequently used survey, and ARIS and ISSP, all these other ones.
Okay. Polls done in the United States have gotten less and less and less accurate because the response rates have been declining. When I was in graduate school, we were taught that if you get less than 85% of the people you draw in your original sample, if less than 85% of them get interviewed, then you've probably got too much bias in your survey. You should be very cautious. Pew is recently reporting 10%, which means that they draw a sample and 90% of the people they draw refuse to be interviewed. It's hard to know what a poll like that will represent. And by the way, I understand that a lot of polling groups are not going to try to predict the 2016 election because they're not sure how to weight their data back from such bad response rates. Gallup does better than Pew, but everybody's got the problem. But these are issues about nations rather than about polling. What happened is that Americans got polled to death. They also got a lot of cell phones, and they're harder to reach than they were. But the fact is that everybody's been surveyed, and usually by people who weren't real surveys. And the response rate is terrible here. In a lot of the world, the response rate is as good as it was 30, 40 years ago in the United States. So in these Gallups that I'm using from 163 nations, in most places they're getting 80, 90% take rates, and it's not an issue. In China, you get almost no turn downs except from Christians.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I happen to be one of these people who, being a social scientist, I love it when I get a call from a polling agency because I get to think through, okay, what are they actually trying to study? And I oftentimes try to game the survey. So I'm one of those people who will respond to it. And I'm probably very different than anybody else they want to reach. So that kind of gives an indication of what kind of bias might be built into some of these things. So in terms of the world poll from Gallup, who is being surveyed in, you mentioned 163 countries. This has been going on since when, about 2004, 2005?
2005 is when they started with about 100 countries.
Okay.
And they very quickly got up to 163. And that's 98% of the world's population are now included in this 163 nations that they're surveying. It's an astonishing achievement. And it leaves me almost breathless that you can compare across that many countries and do all kinds of marvelous things.
Now, is this poll specifically about religion? Are they asking a lot of
questions? Oh, okay. No. As a matter of fact, we've been trying for 3-4 years to raise a couple of million bucks per year so that we can buy in a religious module. No, they only have very, very limited items, but they're enough to draw a lot of conclusions. They ask whether religion is important in your life. They ask what your religion is, if any, and they code that out. So it means for the first time we can start looking at real data on world religions rather than a whole bunch of made-up and guessed data. They ask church attendance or temple attendance or whatever attendance is legitimate. They have a God item that's only in half of the countries. But, it's enough to make a lot out of. For example, it's enough to realize that suddenly, almost overnight, Catholic mass attendance in Latin America has just skyrocketed. It's at an incredible high. It used to be very, very low.
Yeah, that is something surprising. We're going to talk about that in a little bit, and that's one of my favorite regions of the world where I cut my teeth in studying religion. Let's just go ahead and dig into the world in general now before we get to any specific regions. And given what Gallup has been finding, 98% of the world's population, roughly, 163 countries, et cetera, in there. Here's the big question. Is religion fading throughout the world?
Religion has been growing all over the world except in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And we can come back to Europe because Europe is very misleading in terms of the way it's being looked at and represented. But the fact is, 81% of the people in the world claim to belong to what you and I would call an organized religion, you know, one that's got, you know, it's got a structure that meets things like Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and Buddhism and whatnot. 51% claim that in the past 7 days they've been to a religious service. In some parts of the world, it's really high. 71% of the people on Earth say religion's important in their daily lives. A huge number say that they're very concerned about the meaning and purpose of life and that they believe it has a meaning and purpose. And you put that all together and you see a very religious world.
Those last two questions, is religion important in your life and do you believe that life has any meaning, I think are very, very important questions. We oftentimes focus on church attendance, and I know the Gallup poll, it doesn't finally define church attendance by month or several times a year. They usually ask in the last 7 days. But people have a hard time getting there sometimes. The church is far away. There's bad weather circumstances. You got kids and all that kind of stuff. But those questions where you ask people, is religion important in your life? Those things really, really stand out.
They do. They do because you're asking people about what's going on inside them. And it's probably much... I mean, I know a lot of people who find that going to church is bad for their religiousness. They stay home because they find it easier to be religious.
Mm-hmm. One of the other ways to measure this is not only asking people about their religion, but asking about their non-religion, atheism. Has atheism been growing across the globe in recent years?
No. It's an amazing thing. There are only three countries on Earth where more than 20% of the population, but less than 30, admit to being atheists. It's Vietnam and China and one other I can't remember offhand. In most countries, it's below 5%. In Islamic countries, it's below 1%. But as I mentioned earlier, it's at 5% or below in the United States and Canada.
You just mentioned Islam and having a very, very low atheism rate. And one of the other pieces of information that makes headlines is that Islam is the fastest growing religion out there in the world. What does the world poll from Gallup tell us about this or other sources?
Well, the whole assumption was, of course, that Muslims have high fertility, Christians have low fertility, and you sit down and you calculate and you see how soon Islam will overtake Christianity because they have lots of babies. The problem is, of course, that Islam is going through the demographic transition, and many, many Muslim countries are now, in fact, even below replacement level on their fertility. Iran, for example, there are fewer Iranians every year than there were the previous year because their fertility is below replacement. So it's not true that Muslims are going to catch up and pass Christianity because of fertility. And there is almost no conversion to Islam, and Christianity is getting oodles of conversions, and Christianity is the biggest, and it's growing faster.
You mentioned Europe a moment ago. We have talked about Europe in the past, but I think it would be a good idea to review it here again. Europe seems to be the odd character out, and a lot of secularization theorists, Steve Bruce and a few other folks, have really focused on Europe. It's the first to modernize, the first to industrialize. Therefore, if we look at the rest of the world following the same path, they're just going to be like Europe and become all secular. What is the story going on with secular Europe?
Well, there are a lot of things going on in Europe, but the first one is European nations differ a lot in their religiousness. They also differ a lot in their industrial development, their modernity, if you will. People have made a living by taking 70 or 80 countries in the world and running, their gross domestic product per capita and running that against church attendance and showing that there's a big negative correlation, that the higher the GNP per capita, the lower the church attendance. The problem is, all they've told us is that Europe is lower on church attendance and is higher on industrialization. But if you take, say, the 37, 38 European nations and separate them out and look internally, there is no correlation between modernization, development, and religious participation, none. Well, there has to be, if that's what's going on. And since it's not there, you'd say, well, okay, the modernity thing isn't going on. What is going on? One thing that's going on is that nobody ever went to church in Europe. Medieval church attendance was terrible. And what I claim is going on in Europe is lazy churches. Monopoly churches in most European nations, and in Germany, for example, the Lutheran clergy are state employees, covered by civil service, and they even have a union. And one of the things in their union contract is if fewer than eight people show up, they don't have to preach.
Wow.
If I was the minister of Germany, I'd give pretty bad sermons so that people wouldn't come, and then I wouldn't have to get up on Sunday morning.
Yeah, that is a pretty strong disincentive for bringing people into the pews, I can imagine.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is that if churches don't work at it, people don't come. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, when we get to Latin America, we'll see the reason everybody's coming is because everybody's working at it now, and they used not to.
Yeah, let's move on to some of the other parts of the world. And we talked about Europe extensively in previous interviews with you, and we'll refer people back to that, to other podcasts. You can link to those on our website. But some of the stuff that you have been doing has been exploring your insights in different parts of the world and seeing where religiosity is growing, Christianity is growing, and a few other types of religious faiths as well. So let's start with Africa. What is happening religiously on that continent?
It's astonishing. I have nice data from Barrett, who was a wonderful Anglican clergyman who did extraordinary research on religion in Africa. And in 1900, there were hardly any Christians in sub-Saharan Africa. Almost everybody would be classified as belonging to one of the indigenous native traditional religions. Today, it's way over 90% in almost every sub-Saharan African nation are Christians. Their attendance rates are astonishing. It's right now there are more Christians in sub-Saharan Africa than in any other continent. And they're incredible churchgoers. And one of the reasons is there are 11,000 Christian African originated denominations. In other words, everywhere you turn around, there is a Christian church that originated with African Christians. And it's just astonishing, and they all work hard to get members, and they've got them.
Yeah, this is one of the fascinating things I really want to point out to people in the book, because if you think about Africa, and you mentioned that in 1900 there are hardly any Christians, the first thing that will pop into everybody's minds is, oh, missionaries. And there were missionaries there. Some of them quit because they just, then weren't that motivated. But the indigenous churches, the ones that you say are created there, which have different names. They're not your Presbyterian or Lutheran, but they're independently named churches have been growing absolutely phenomenally. And you think back to this in relationship to Europe and what you were saying a minute ago, where the churches are largely state-sponsored or state-supported. Here you have basically a free market of religion, and once you allow that, boom, Cambrian explosion of religiosity and Christianity.
Yeah, and the thing to remember, too, in all of this is that the Catholics weren't patsies. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church is very healthy in sub-Saharan Africa. And as you might recall, there are a whole bunch of black African cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic Church was very, very early at ordaining African priests, and it worked. I had a friend contact the Vatican for me because a couple years ago I looked at the most recent Catholic World Almanac and looked at their claimed membership for the sub-Saharan African countries, and they were way, way below what I was getting projecting from the Gallup data. And by the way, remember, the Gallup data are cumulative, so that I'm not relying on, say, a one poll of 1,000 people in an African country, but maybe they've been there 10 years and I got 11,000 people to look at. That's for great stability in projecting your rates. And so I had asked the Catholics in the Vatican why they were so, about this discrepancy. Well, they were delighted to find out that there were more Catholics in Latin in South Africa than they thought there were. But they didn't know why. And finally, one of them said, look, I think the priests down there are so busy that they haven't got time to count. That may be the best answer of them all.
Yeah, people coming in pretty rapidly. It'd be difficult to keep track of them all the time, I can imagine.
But, I mean, we're talking about big differences. The Catholic Almanac would say we've got 22% of the members of the people in Country X are Catholics, and the Gallup World Poll is showing it's 39%.
Yeah. So,
I mean, these are big differences.
Yeah. Interesting. One of the other things that comes up with Africa, and you just were mentioning Southern Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa, not necessarily the country of South Africa, but below the Saharan Desert.
Right.
There's been a lot of talk about Islam. Islam is predominant in North Africa. To what extent is it spreading southward into West Africa or other places such as Kenya that might be considered Sub-Saharan?
Well, wherever there is the Christian South abuts with the Muslim North, there's been terrible conflict of late. This whole Boko Haram thing in Nigeria is just, terrible. And it's because Islam has gotten more and more frustrated because they can't make converts in the South. So they've gone to terrorism, which hasn't helped them either. But the point is that Islam doesn't seem to be very exportable. Christianity does.
Now, your book, again, covers a lot of different regions in the world. Africa, we've seen a seismic shift in religiosity over the past century. The other place that might be occurring right before our eyes is China. And particularly with respect to Christianity, although you see also some increases in other denominations there are other faith traditions, including Islam. You recently wrote a book with Zhihua Wang called A Star in the East, The Rise of Christianity in China. So not only do you have a chapter in your book, The Triumph of Faith, but you have an entire book on this China itself. What is happening religiously in that country, and why is there such a rapid increase in Christianity there?
Well, I think that and I have got a lot of Chinese intellectuals who agree with me that modern China has a problem, which is this is an advanced industrial modern scientific economy and culture. They've got cars, they've got laboratories, they've got the whole deal. And traditional Asian faiths are very inconsistent with that because they are not faiths of progress, they're faiths of decline. That is to say, history is going downhill. Things used to be better. Well, the Chinese look around and it's not very consistent with, say, the ancients really had a wonderful utopia and we're now just living in misery compared to them. They know better. Mm-hmm. And there's Christianity, a religion that is a religion of progress. Things are getting better, and that the universe is rational and can be understood because God is rational and created a rational universe, etc. All of this is very consistent. The Chinese say, "Look, we took your science, we took your industry. Maybe it's time we took your religion." In any event, it is the most educated Chinese who are the most apt to have converted to Christianity in China.
And that's completely in conflict with secularization theory. You would figure it's just the dumb backwater farmer people and stuff. But
right.
It's the modern
That's discipline. Never been true.
Yeah, yeah.
You take something like the Methodists, and when they started, they really appealed to the poor, right? Yeah, but they started at Oxford. They didn't start in the West End. Almost any religious Christian movement one can think of started with the educated and the sophisticated, and that's true around the world. Buddha was not some farmer. I mean, he was a prince. There's some thought that only really the people who've got time on their hands because they're privileged have got time to concern themselves with the fact of what does it all mean, and to feel spiritually deprived. The farmer has got a lot of work to do. He hasn't got time to think about that.
Yeah, they may be religious, but they might not necessarily be developing the religious organizations.
Yeah, they're not reflective about the religion. Yeah, because that's not the life they're leading. In any event, Chinese, if you want to find Christians, go to the campuses. There's something else in China that's very fascinating. At least out in the villages, the local communist officials are very open about being Christians. I mean, you know, here's the village communist chief, right? And he's got a cross on his front door. It's against the law for a Communist Party member to be religious. But there are plenty of Christian Communist Party officials, and so, one really not wonders how all that's going to play out. But it probably is a factor in preventing crackdowns.
Yeah, this is something that I wanted to ask you. It's not encompassed in the triumph of faith, but you do address it in the Star in the East, and that is, how is the Communist Party going to manage its own atheist ideology, its skepticism of religion against this growing popularity of Christianity? We hear of churches being bulldozed. We hear of repression. We hear of the Chinese sponsoring an official Christian church. This is the one. If you have to choose Christianity, choose this one. But it seems like that's a very tenuous managerial strategy.
Yeah, well, I can't claim that I know what's going to happen in China, because, that's preposterous. Could go many different ways. One of the things I think that is more likely to keep it hands off with Christianity is that my guess is a whole lot of sons and daughters of the party leaders are Christians. Mm-hmm. And that may be of some importance. It's a very, very strange world. Take the underground church, so-called. All that means is we're not registered with the government. We refuse to register. As for being underground, some of the underground churches are 6 and 7 stories tall, and you can't get that underground.
Yeah. We did a podcast with Carrie Casel a couple times back in the past, and she talks about some of these very large churches where they're just big warehouses, and they slide open the door, and there's these fog machines and laser light shows with Christianity, with Christian music blaring and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Anyway, it's all we'll have to see. It's a very interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, as you're mentioning this too, I thought back to your book, The Rise of Christianity, and how this played out over the first 300 years of Christian history. And during the period of Constantine, as you mentioned, a lot of the sons and daughters of prominent Roman officials and military advisors were Christians. And it became pretty much impossible to get the military to oppress these folks when their family members were participating in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
I can wonder if that will be playing out in China anytime soon. What about the other Asian countries in the region? You talk about the four Asian tigers, which are South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore. Are we witnessing a similar thing going on that we saw in China?
Not really. I mean, there are some Christians there, and there's some growth, but it's very low key. Japan is not doing anything. I mean, with any. I mean, Japan's a pretty miserable society right now. I mean, we've got huge numbers of their young people say they never want to get married, and it's a very depressed culture at the moment, and it's hard to know how that's going to work out. But it's still the mysterious East.
Yeah, no. Let me ask about Japan, because you do have a chapter in that, and it's not Christianizing as rapidly as China and to some extent South Korea. South Korea has seen significant Christian growth in recent years, but it does sound depressing. People in Japan don't want to get married, and being married, having children, is a big predictor of going back to church. But
right.
is this one of the examples of an atheist nation that secularization theorists could hold up and say, "Wow, this is the future." No, okay.
No. They're heavy into supernaturalism. It's just that they don't really have any churches. You can't even get insurance on your car in Japan if you haven't had it blessed by a local priest. You can't get a loan to build a house unless you've had a Shinto priest come over and purify the land. So it's very, there's a lot of supernaturalism. It's just that there aren't any churches. And that's kind of made a mess out of things, I think.
Yeah, we just had a discussion with Ron Hassner a few months ago, too, about religion in the military. And one of the things that surprised me was that even high-up military officers, even though it is against the military code to engage in any religious behavior, will not get into tanks or any other type of military equipment, fighter planes or whatever, without them being blessed by a Shinto priest. Right. So to say that, oh, this is all atheist, but nonetheless, just to be careful, we want to make sure that F-15 gets blessed by a Shinto priest before we get
right. in. Alan Miller, who was one of my very best students, who unfortunately died very young, had a faculty appointment in Japan at a Japanese university. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to build a house, and he literally could not get a loan from any bank unless he had a Shinto priest come and, that cost $1,500. Was listed as a closing cost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Yeah. I mean, it's that taken for granted.
Yeah. Fascinating. Another region of the world that you tackle is one that I'm very familiar with, and that's Latin America. And here, I think most people would assume that not much has changed over the last century because it's a really Catholic region. You think of Catholicism when you think of Mexico or Argentina and the big churches that are always in the town center. So why bother mentioning the triumph of faith in Latin America if it's always been triumphant there?
Well, you might remember there's only been the last couple of years it's been legal in Mexico for a priest to appear in public wearing priestly garb. And it used to be that if you want to know how many Catholics there were in a Latin American country, you just looked up the census figure, because that's what the cardinal did. He would report to Rome. As a matter of fact, I've looked at the 1949 International Catholic Yearbook, and they were reporting for places like Argentina and Brazil 99.7%, 98.9% as Catholics. But nobody ever went to church. Mm-hmm. And most of those people weren't even baptized. So it was, it wasn't even a mile wide and an inch deep. It was all a fiction. And then, of course, the Protestants finally were permitted in some of these countries, partly in response to antagonism between the government and the church. Protestant missionaries got in there and got some converts, and then it started flowing. And, when I was still at Washington and you and I used to talk, it looked like Latin America was going Protestant in a real hurry. And the Catholics responded with liberation theology, which did nothing. It was a bad mix of politics and religion, the worst of both. And then suddenly came the Catholic Charismatic Movement, and suddenly the Catholic Church gathered itself and started meeting head-on with the Pentecostal Protestants, offering very energetic religion. And guess what? The Catholics started coming to church, and the Catholic Church started building up, and the Protestantization of Latin America slowed way down. But the Roman Catholicization, if you will, of Latin America really took off. And we are talking about, there are countries in Latin America today where 70% of the Catholics are going to Mass on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And in most of them, it's 60. Oh, That's unheard of. It's not that way in any of the Catholic other Catholic countries around the world. In Spain, it's about 30%. Latin America is just a religious hotbed right now.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really surprised me in my own research, because when I started doing this, I thought, well, everybody's Catholic down there. They're reporting all the numbers. But it was this religious competition that was introduced that really lit the fire under the Catholic Church. And it's not only do you see this in survey data, but in my time down there and talking with different bishops and priests, they basically admit this. They say, the thing that helped us to get more people into the pews on Sunday was to have a Protestant church down the road, because we couldn't sit or repose ourselves on our benefices, to use Adam Smith's language. And they really had to focus on this. And one of the things that is going on, you mentioned charismatic Catholicism, is that they're not only directly competing in terms of a zero-sum game with these Protestants, but they're learning from them. It's been a positive-sum game.
This is an old story. It happened in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Catholics coming to the United States in the middle of the 19th century were lousy Catholics, because they were coming from Europe where they hadn't been much. You got baptized, you got married, you got buried, and that was it. And Protestants started making inroads on these Catholic immigrants, and the church quickly learned and started holding Catholic versions of revival meetings and whatnot. And the Catholic Church, by the turn of the start of the 20th century, the American Catholic Church was the strongest Catholic Church in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because of competition. And the fact remains that, let me tell you a story. When I was a very young newspaper reporter, I was working for the Oakland Tribune, and I can't remember why, but they sent me out to talk to the pastor of what was one of the largest Catholic churches in Oakland. And I went out and talked to him, and we got on great. He was a wonderful old gentleman, and of course he had some young assistants there. And I got talking about the assistants. He said, well, they send them here for training. He said, they work here for a while, and then they can get a parish of their own. And we were talking about training the young priests, and he said, here, I'll show you what I do to every young priest when he shows up, the first thing. We walked out onto the porch of this big church, and right across the street was a white wooden frame, small church, bell tower, and a huge neon sign that says, Jesus Saves Italian Pentecostal Church. And as I take him out here, and I point over there, and I tell him, everybody over there came from over here. And I said, remember that anytime you feel like cutting any corners. He said, we'll just lose more people if you do.
Yeah.
And it was making both churches much stronger.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really insightful, because again, people oftentimes view competition in a negative light, but it really has a very positive sum aspect to it. And I know you're talking about seminarians and ordinations. The other bit of evidence that Catholicism has grown much stronger in recent years in Latin America is that they're relying less upon imported priests, which they had to do in the middle part of the 20th century, and ordinations have skyrocketed there.
Oh. Their seminary enrollments have gone from about, they've increased by about 6 or 7 times in the last 25 years.
Yeah, another indication. If you're a strong church, people want to be working with you.
I mean, Latin America had always depended almost entirely on imported foreign priests, but now they're pretty much able to staff them themselves, and that's a huge change.
Let's finish up with a religion that we haven't talked very much about yet, but it is in the news quite a bit, and that's Islam. Most Westerners probably would view the region of the world, the Middle East, maybe extending from Morocco through Saudi Arabia and then all the way to Malaysia, as always having been quite religious. But you have a chapter in your book devoted to this topic, and it is called Islam Intensified. What do you mean by that?
Well, it means that things were a lot more casual 50 years ago. There was It was a much more easygoing low level of practice sort of faith. There were a lot of Muslims who drank, and there weren't all that many people who went on their pilgrimage to Mecca, for example. In the 40s and 50s, let's say the 50s, because then we don't have to worry about World War II or any of that, they're getting about 50,000 a year coming to Mecca. Well, now it's 3 million, and it could be probably 20 million, except the Saudis can't handle more than 3 million out there in the desert. And so that's how many visas they'll give out. But they turn down an enormous number of applicants. And that's just one little sliver of it. Every measure you can possibly find that you can dig out to look at shows that Islam has had a really potent revival in the last 50 years, and of course there's a bright side and there's a dark side, and the dark side we're living with.
Yeah, what do you think accounts for that intensification? I mean, you're dealing largely with the empirical evidence showing that it's occurring, but any speculation or ideas of why Islam has intensified over the past few decades?
Yeah, well, I mean, an enormous amount of this is nationalism, resentment, antagonism to Western morals, all kinds of things going on, and it's important to realize we have a notion, the same kind of notion of Islam that they have of Christianity. They think of Christianity as one big church, and we have a tendency to think of Islam as one big church. Not so. It's fractured 9,000 different directions, and there's a lot of intensity and a lot of antagonism and a whole lot of competition for followers. I have a friend that told me that if I went with him to any Muslim village in which, say, there were four mosques, okay, mm-hmm. He said, I would be able to show you the Baptist mosque, the Lutheran mosque, the Episcopalian mosque, and the Unitarian mosque. That there's an enormous variety inside of Islam, and they're all busy working against each other. And it makes sense that the end of colonialism, of course, took a lot of lids off.
Yeah, yeah. Variety is the spice of life, and it's also the engine of competition, both negative sum and positive sum, in many respects.
Hey, by the way, while we're talking about Islam, let me bring up something. You know, all this business that you shouldn't say the terrorists are radical Muslims. You should say there's something else, isn't there? That is the most anti-Muslim thing you can possibly do, because everybody knows that they're Muslims. I mean, you can't, the man's name is Muhammad, and you're going to say he's a Swede? I mean, come on. By saying it's a radical Muslim, you're saying most Muslims aren't like that. When you refuse to make that statement, you let people think that maybe most Muslims are like that. And of course, that's a whole issue that one is hard to get into too. I mean, I've got survey data that are not very encouraging from Muslim countries.
Well, that we're going to have to leave for another time and show, because we're approaching the end of our interview here, and I want to leave off with one question that wraps around to the beginning of our podcast, talking about seculars and atheism, and it really floats through the entire book that you've written, The Triumph of Faith, and that's this notion of secularization and secularism, and it's the one place where secularization is alive and well is probably the modern academy, and then followed quickly by the modern media punditry. And
right.
With all this evidence piling up, including Peter Berger, a well-known sociologist who two decades ago recanted on his secularization thesis and said, you know what, I was absolutely wrong, which is, by the way, remarkable for an academic to do, to ever admit that they're wrong, and Berger did it in a very graceful way. What is your thought about whether or not secularization theory is going to be dumped in the academy or not. It just seems that the evidence is piling up overwhelmingly that it's not right. So why is it still holding on so fiercely, and will it fade in the future?
I've kind of half given up hope for the academy right now. It's bizarre what they're able to believe without blinking an eye. And I don't know when that could possibly be rectified, but they believe so many things that are utterly silly. It isn't just secularization by any means. I mean, there's still the people in there saying that there is no such thing as mental illness.
Well, that is probably not the most optimistic way to leave off, but the fact that religion and religiosity still remain strong in the world is actually a fairly good sign. And your book, The Triumph of Faith, makes a really good case for the fact that religion still remains a vital part of people's lives around the world. My guest today has been Rodney Stark. Rod, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
It was delightful. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.